Over the last few years, Burma has undergone an astonishing transformation from a repressive dictatorship to a developing democracy. But unlike the revolutions in Egypt and Tunisia last year, the changes in Burma have been initiated by the repressive military rulers themselves, of course, after years of pressure from both the Burmese people and international heavyweights. New Yorker staff writer Evan Osnos visited Burma to see how its citizens are responding to the changes and to the potential for democracy. His article, The Burmese Spring, appears in the August 6th issue of the magazine, and I'm pleased that it brings him to our show for today's first backstory segment. Evan, welcome to the Leonard LoPage Show.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
So my first question to you is, over the past few years, we've been told we should refer to this country as Myanmar. Why did you choose to call it Burma in your story?
I think it's a measure of the fact that there is a lot we still don't yet know about where this process is going. And historically, using the name Burma has been, in a sense, a vote of solidarity with the opposition and a vote of skepticism against the government. And for the moment, there are a lot of people who are still cautious, and they say, let's move slowly, and the name is a symbolically important fact.
It is so interesting how names continue to have such power.
It's true, and in this case, what you find is that over the years, people who specialize in this subject or who spend a lot of time working on Burma have had to make an accommodation, in a sense, to the complexity of it. So what you see is a lot of books, for instance, that have the title Burma/Myanmar. And it's a completely convoluted solution, but it's the only one that has allowed people to not render a judgment on the cover of their books, because they want to allow, ultimately, the contents to be the definition of what they believe.
Had you been to Burma before you visited this past spring?
I hadn't. And part of that was because for years, Aung San Suu Kyi, the most famous opposition figure in the country, had said that tourism was not a good idea, and her party had agreed with her on that. And so it made it difficult. I've lived in China for 7 years, and it's just over the border, and I wanted to go for a long time, partly because I wanted to understand what's happening inside the country, but also because of what it tells us about the nature of authoritarianism. But it was really only this spring that I finally had permission, in a sense, to go, because Aung San Suu Kyi had said now, and a lot of people in the opposition movement had said, it's time for a change, and it's time for people to come. And so that's when I started traveling to Burma.
What was your first impression of the country, just visually, when you landed, taking a look at what was around you?
It is astonishing. And I say this as somebody who, I think like a lot of us, you know, you travel a lot these days, and you become accustomed to the idea that no matter where you go, there will be certain visual cues that you recognize. It'll be brand names. It'll be a Samsung sign or a Coca-Cola sign or something that just signifies that you are at home in the world. And yet you step foot in Burma, in Rangoon or Yangon, as it's now known, the cultural capital, commercial capital of the country, and it's as if you've stepped into another decade, because of the economic sanctions, the restrictions that have been imposed on the country to pressure the regime, there are almost no recognizable brand names. And that's a strange and slightly disorienting fact. You go and you look at the shelves in the grocery store, and instead of Crest and Colgate toothpaste, there's Pop, and there's some other brand name you've never heard of, because it exists entirely in its own universe. And then if you step outside and you look at the buildings themselves, Burma was a British colony, and as a result, it has this old colonial architecture. But unlike some places like Shanghai or Hanoi that have sort of celebrated that architecture and tried to keep it up, turn it into a tourist attraction, in Burma, it actually has just deteriorated steadily and dramatically over the years. And so now you see these incredible tropical trees growing out of the middle of these colonial villas. And on the streets, you see buses that were donated decades ago to Burma that are now sort of barely holding themselves together, completely overloaded. It strikes you in a strange way as a country that has sort of gradually fallen out of step with the world, which is a distinction from a country. There are places where a lot of us have been that have not yet caught up to globalization and have not yet caught up to the world. But that's what makes Burma so distinctive, because it used to be a very cosmopolitan place. In the 1930s, the mayor of Rangoon was Jewish, which is a sign of how diverse the place was. And yet today, it feels as if it is more or less living on its own planet.
It does. It sounds like it's a stage set for another era, not our current time.
It is, and that's I think there's something seductive about that as an experience, about going to a place that is so isolated in an age in which very few places seem isolated at all. And I think it's one of the reasons why people over the years have, people who get involved in Burma and in issues associated with it, become very attached in the livelihood and the well-being of the people. And it's one of the reasons why it's become what's known in Washington as a boutique issue, which means that most people in America have never thought much about Burma. But for those who have, it's an issue that they don't quickly forget.
I'm speaking with Evan Osnos from The New Yorker. His article, The Burmese Spring, is in the August 6th edition of the magazine. You mentioned at the beginning that part of what drew you is to look at the nature of authoritarianism and what happens to a country when, and I'm inferring this from your article, when there are cracks in that. Mm. Did you find the stories surprising when you arrived in Burma and you started hearing people talk about what was going on there?
Very surprising. I think it was a unique experience for a few reasons. One, I've been living in China over the course of this period when it has gone through this extraordinary economic boom at the very same time that it maintains one of the world's largest and most durable authoritarian systems. And that paradox is interesting, and ultimately it's one of the things that keeps me in China, wanting to understand how that works. When you go to Burma these days, what you're seeing is the unraveling of the world's longest-running military dictatorship. And yet, it has not unraveled with the usual iconography, the things that we expect. We sort of come to expect certain things in political transition. There's supposed to be crowds in the street. There's supposed to be people picking through a ruined palace. And there has not been, so far, that experience in Burma. It has been a bloodless, relatively bloodless change.
Although the crowds in the streets happened at other times and were violently, you know, the crowds of Buddhist monks
Absolutely.
Were violently dealt with by these authoritarian.
Absolutely right. And so what the story becomes, it's tempting in a sense to oversimplify this and say, well, it's about authoritarians who decided that their time had come and that they had to open up to their people. But that really is only part of it, because to understand the story of what's happening in Burma, you have to go back a few years and look at, exactly as you mentioned, this pattern of public unrest that began really in 1988, which is the first time that the Burmese people rose up against the military regime. And that's the first time that the world ever heard the name Aung San Suu Kyi. And that's when Burma's people and their government began this long and brutal deadlock, in which the government basically said, we're going nowhere. We're going to stay here. This is a military regime. And yet the people, unlike, for instance, in China, where there has been economic growth during this period, Burma was deteriorating, and its economy was imploding. And so people receded further and further away. And every few years, particularly in 2007, when the monks rose up against the regime in what became known as the Saffron Revolution around the world, that was, for a lot of people in the government, a very clear indicator that they had lost any support among the public. And if they did nothing, then they would be swept aside. And that's really the beginning, in some sense, of what we're seeing today.
How have you seen this play out? Because making this sort of change, even with that kind of wake-up call, is not easy when a regime has been in place for all of these years.
So there's a couple of key things that happened. One was that when the Burmese government opened fire on the monks in 2007, it drew lines within its own military and within its own government between those who found that moment, who said that action was the necessary thing to maintain stability, basically people who said it was the right thing to do, and then the very large and angry group within the military regime that said, you have violated a line we can never cross, which is that you have opened fire on the most revered institution in the country, the monks. I mean, this is, after all, a Buddhist country that has deep attachments between faith and the legitimacy of the government. And it was at that moment that you began to have mid-level officials in the government, sort of middle-aged generals who were rising up through this regime, who said, this is not a system that we can take part in anymore. And they began quietly to find each other. And at the same time, there were people outside of government, people in civil society, academics, journalists, particularly businessmen, who said, the moment has come for a change. If we don't change, we will fall further and further out of step with the world. By this point, Burma already had arguably the lowest investment in health and education of any country in the world. It had a lower GDP than Laos, its neighbor. It had a lower use of cell phones than any country in the world, even behind North Korea. And they said something has got to change. And it was that where it germinated, in that alliance between members of the public and members, sort of rising members of the regime.
So what you describe here and also in your article is a change that's happening, as you say, that doesn't fit the usual signposts of a move towards democracy. What are the big signposts in this particular move that you see?
Well, there were a couple of interesting moments that at the time, frankly, people did not really realize were as significant as they were. If you go back a year ago, the outgoing dictator of Burma, a guy whose name was Thanh Shwe, who'd been in office for 18 years, he really, in many ways, satisfied all of what we expect of a dictator. I mean, he, at one point, according to sources at the embassy, at the U.S. Embassy in Rangoon, he considered spending $1 billion to buy the soccer club Manchester United as a gift to his grandson, who was a soccer fan. This, of course, at a time when his country was one of the poorest on earth. And at the very end of 2010, at the beginning of 2011, Thanh Shwe said, I'm stepping aside, I'm naming a president as successor. And frankly, a lot of us didn't take it seriously because there wasn't a whole lot of reason to do so. The person he named, whose name is Thein Sein, was a lifelong military man, a career general. He'd been the acting prime minister at the time that the government opened fire on the monks. And so a lot of people, frankly, wrote him off and said, this guy is going to be a puppet of the old dictator. Dictators don't retire. It just doesn't happen. And then, over the course of a few months, it became very clear that Thein Sein was not quite the man who he appeared to be. Since then, we've come to learn some interesting facts about him. For one thing, he was the guy in charge of the government's response to the terrible typhoon which swept across Burma in 2008. This is a natural disaster that killed 135,000 people. And the government's response to it was completely inept. They actually originally declined any foreign assistance because they believed they might be invaded. So he was the guy in charge of this. But ultimately, he really wasn't calling the shots. He was the one who was nominally in charge. But frankly, what it gave him was a front row seat to how dysfunctional the government had become. So if he had any inklings that this government had a responsibility to be better towards its people, that was a moment when it was demonstrated to him in clear, unambiguous terms. The other thing that's interesting about him was that in his years as the prime minister to a dictator, which, after all, is not a very demanding job, he had had the opportunity to visit countries abroad. And that is something we forget, that this government in Burma had become unbelievably isolated.
Mm-hmm.
So he had this chance to go to these other cities. He walked around. He saw what the world really was. And he began to realize how far Burma had fallen. Those were two key facts in his experience.
And you write also that once he was named president, a businessman gave him DVDs of The West Wing to show him what an executive branch might be able to do.
That's right. I mean, it's one of those, I think that was one of the details that helped me understand how truly isolated this regime had become. I mean, one of the a prominent businessman there whose brother is a very senior military figure told me, he said, you know, it's impossible for you as Americans to really understand how remote these guys are. He said, my brother has spent almost 30 years in the military. He's at the highest possible rank, and he has spent all of 3 days outside of this country, and it was for a conference in Thailand. So the country, in a sense, the Burmese government didn't even realize how grotesque it had become and how reviled it was. And it only began to happen in the last few years. And one of the ways they did that was by, frankly, giving DVDs of the West Wing to the president so that he could see actually what a government, a Western government, is at least supposed to look like on screen. And that was not the only one. In fact, I've spoken to people at the United Nations who had quietly begun a kind of underground railroad of books that they were sending into the government. They were, you know, books that would never be allowed to be sold. Books about, for instance, the transition from authoritarianism and about developing your economy. These kinds of things, which would have been banned in Burma, were being quietly shipped in to members of the government. In one case, there was a member of the government who was so grateful that every time he received books, he would send a box of mangoes to the UN official who was sending him the books. And so there was this, that was sort of quietly going on beneath the surface.
You know, and it's interesting hearing you talk about this. It sounds like Aung San Suu Kyi offered a number of challenges then to the authoritarian rulers. One was her relationship to her father, but another was, here's this woman who was raised and lived in Oxford and for whom the modern world was a place that she had called home.
You're absolutely right, and that's one of the reasons why she was reviled by the government. I mean, the old dictator, Thanh Chui, it's well known that he wouldn't allow her name to be mentioned in his presence. And she has an interesting story, quite unlike, frankly, any other biography in public life. She is the daughter of the most famous person in modern Burmese history, the revolutionary hero. His name is Aung San, and he was the one who brokered independence from the British. He ultimately led Burma through the Second World War. And then he was assassinated when she was 2 years old. And she grew up in the care of her mother, who was named the Burmese ambassador to India and Nepal. So Aung San Suu Kyi, as a teenager, moved to India, was raised among the Indian elite in Delhi. It's one of the places that she got her kind of perfect English diction, and one of the places where she was raised essentially in a British boarding school, more or less, in India. And then she went on to Oxford, worked at the United Nations, but, you know, she didn't actually set out to be the world's most, arguably most famous political prisoner, up until the last few years. She had settled into a suburban life in Oxford, and it was in 1988 when her mother had a stroke that she went back to Burma for what she said was going to be a one-week trip to go tend to her mother. And in the course of that 1 week, she was swept up into this public uprising and became the face and the leader of the opposition, partly because of her name, but also because she did turn out to have a sort of preternatural knack for leading the Burmese people against the government. And she gave a speech that became very decisive. But for that reason, because she had this pedigree, she was always perceived as the greatest threat to the regime because they didn't understand what she wanted and where she came from.
And that adds poignancy to, there's so much loss and violence in this story, the story that's come up to this moment. But you write about how her husband, who was living in England, desperately asked to come visit her when he was dying and was refused.
She spent, you're right, 15 of the last 21 years under house arrest. And in the course of that process, the regime imposed a kind of steady drumbeat of humiliations against her and a lot of other opposition figures who most people have never heard of. But her case is at least the best known, and so it can be illustrative. I mean, in the case of her husband, Michael Arras, who is a Tibet scholar at Oxford, he was dying of prostate cancer, and he asked repeatedly for the opportunity for a visa to visit Burma so that he could see his wife before he died. And the government said no over and over again, partly because it hoped that she would leave. Mm-hmm. And then if she left in order to see him, then she wouldn't be allowed back in. And eventually she recorded a videotaped message to him, and it was smuggled out with the help of of friends abroad, and the videotape arrived at their home in Oxford on the day after her husband died.
Oh.
And, you know, in a way, I think one of the extraordinary things over the course of the last few months has been the fact that the world, people like me, have been able to go in and begin to learn about the rest of the 55 million people in Burma. Because, in a sense, over the last generation, we've had no choice but to understand Burma and the people's struggle through the experience and the aspirations of this one individual, Aung San Suu Kyi. And her story is extraordinary. But the thing that's really amazing now is to be able to go and, for the very first time, talk to people about what they have gone through. And in a sense, it came to feel to me over the course of my trips there as if it was like the whole country was getting out of jail and beginning to tell its story.
Literally and figuratively.
Absolutely.
Having done this, one of the things that affected me in reading your article was the sense that there are a number of people who want to, I don't know whether pretend is the right word, but want to push what has happened away and say, we want to start new. Is that something, though, that you think is possible given the repression and the pain and the violence and the loss that has happened over the past 40 years?
You know, that's one of the great questions that they're facing at the moment, is how to deal with the issue of accountability. Because when you look at their neighbor, for instance, in Cambodia, one of the things that Cambodia has struggled with is how to reckon with the crimes of the Khmer Rouge era and the genocide. And it has had a very difficult time of it. There's an international tribunal which has managed to bring people to court and to try to reckon with that history. But at the same time, in Burma's case, the fear is that the lines between the victimizers and the victims were in many cases so fuzzy. Somebody might be a victimizer on Monday. They might be a member of the government, or they might be an informer, for instance. And then on Tuesday, they might find themselves as the victim. They might be the one who is informed upon, the one who is reported to the police for having, for instance, a banned book, or the person who's sent to jail for telling a joke about the dictator. That the lines have become so blurry, and that there are so many layers of abuse and of victimization that they don't know where it will end. And that's the fear. I was surprised, frankly, when I went, that I did not hear more people saying to me, we need to begin the process of seeking accountability. And I think that's basically because the country is coming from a state of such deprivation at the moment. Even now, it is still in a state of such economic extremists. I mean, look, it basically got its first ATM machine last November. It had them once years and years ago, and they disappeared. So, you know, the central bank, for instance, one of the key departments at the central bank has three computers. This is a country that really needs desperately to enter the economic mainstream. And so I heard a lot of people, particularly, frankly, people who I would have thought would have been demanding justice, saying to me, there will be a time for reconciliation. But first, we need to get to dry land, and that's where their priorities seem to lie at the moment.
Well, Evan, thank you so much. I've been speaking with The New Yorker staff writer Evan Osnos about the major changes in Burma over the last 2 years. His article, The Burmese Spring, appears in the August 6th issue of the magazine. Evan, thanks so much for joining us today for the first Backstory segment.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.